Chapter 5 1 My idea is to become a Rothschild. I invite the listener to keep calm and not to excite himself. I repeat it. My idea is to become a Rothschild, to become as rich as Rothschild. Not simply rich, but rich as Rothschild. What objects I have in view, what for and why, all that shall come later. First I will simply show that the attainment of my object is a mathematical certainty. It is a very simple matter. The whole secret lies in two words, obstinacy and perseverance. We have heard that, it's nothing new, people will tell me. Every Vater in Germany repeats this to his children, and meanwhile your Rothschild, James Rothschild the Parisian is the one I mean, is unique while there are millions of such Vaters. I should answer, you assert that you've heard it, but you've heard nothing. It's true that you're right about one thing. When I said that this was very simple, I forgot to add that it is most difficult. All the religions and the moralities of the world amount to one thing, love virtue and avoid vice. One would think nothing could be simpler. But just try doing something virtuous and giving up any one of your vices. Just try it. It's the same with this. That's why your innumerable German Vaters may, for ages past reckoning, have repeated those two wonderful words which contain the whole secret, and, meanwhile, Rothschild remains unique. It shows it's the same but not the same, and these Vaters don't repeat the same idea. No doubt they too have heard of obstinacy and perseverance, but to attain my object, what I need is not these German Vaters' obstinacy, or these Vaters' perseverance. The mere fact that he is a Vater, I don't mean only the Germans, that he has a family, that he is living like other people, has expenses like other people, has obligations like other people, means that he can't become a Rothschild, but must remain an average man. I understand quite clearly that in becoming a Rothschild, or merely desiring to become one, not in the German Vater's way, but seriously, I must at the same time cut myself off from society. Some years ago, I read in the newspaper that on one of the steamers on the Volga, there died a beggar who went about begging in rags and was known to everyone. On his death, they found sewn up in his shirt 3,000 rubles in notes. The other day I read of another beggar of the respectable sort, who used to go about the restaurants holding out his hand. He was arrested, and there was found on him 5,000 rubles. Two conclusions follow directly from this. The first, that obstinacy in saving even the smallest coin will still produce enormous results in the long run. Time is of no account in this. And secondly, that the most unskillful form of accumulation, if only persevering, is mathematically certain of success. Meanwhile, there are perhaps a good number of respectable, clever, obstinate people who cannot save either 3 or 5,000, however much they struggle, though they would be awfully glad to have such a sum. Why is that? The answer is clear. It is because not one of them, in spite of all their wishing it, desires it to such a degree that, for instance, if he is not able to save by other means, he is ready to become a beggar, and so persistent that after becoming a beggar he will not waste the first farthing he is given on an extra crust of bread for himself or his family. With this system of saving, that is, in beggary, one must live on bread and salt and nothing more to save up such sums, at least so I imagine. That is no doubt what the two beggars I have mentioned above did do. They must have eaten nothing but bread and have lived almost in the open air. There is no doubt that they had no intention of becoming Rothschilds. They were simply Harpagons or Ilyushkins in their purest form, nothing more. But when there is intelligent accumulation in quite a different form, with the object of becoming a Rothschild, no less strength of will is needed than in the case of those two beggars. The German farter does not show such strength of will. There are many kinds of strength in the world, especially of strength of will and of desire. There is the temperature of boiling water, and there is the temperature of molten iron. One wants here the same thing as in a monastery, the same heroic asceticism. Feeling is wanted, not only idea. What for? Why? Is it moral and not monstrous to wear sackcloth and eat black bread all one's life to heap up filthy lucre? These questions I will consider later. Now I am discussing only the possibility of attaining the object. When I thought of my idea, and it was forged in white heat, I began asking myself, am I capable of asceticism? With this object, for the whole of the first month, I took bread and water, not more than 2.5 pounds of black bread a day. To do this, I was obliged to deceive Nikolai Semyonovich, who was clever, and Marie Ivanovna, who was anxious for my welfare, though I wounded her and somewhat surprised Nikolai Semyonovich, who was a man of great delicacy. I insisted on having my dinner brought to my room. There I simply got rid of it. I poured the soup out of the window onto the nettles or elsewhere. The meat I either flung out of the window to a dog, or, wrapping it up in paper, put it in my pocket and threw it away after, and so on. As the bread given me for dinner was much less than 2.5 pounds, I bought bread on the sly. I stood this for a month, perhaps, only upsetting my stomach a little. But the next month I added soup to the bread, and drank a glass of tea morning and evening. And I assure you, I passed a year like that in perfect health and content, as well as in a moral ecstasy and perpetual secret delight. Far from regretting the dainties I missed, I was overjoyed. At the end of the year, having convinced myself I was capable of standing any fast, however severe, I began eating as they did, and went back to dine with them. Not satisfied with this experiment, I made a second. Apart from the sum paid to Nikolai Semyonovich for my board, I was allowed 5 rubles a month for pocket money. I resolved to spend only half. This was a very great trial, but after at most 2 years I had in my pocket by the time I went to Petersburg 70 rubles saved entirely in this way, besides other money. The result of these two experiments was of vast importance to me. I had learnt positively that I could so will a thing as to attain my objects, and that, I repeat, is the essence of my idea. The rest is all nonsense. Let us, however, look into the nonsense too. I have described my two experiments. In Petersburg, as the listener knows, I made a third. I went to the auction, and at one stroke made a profit of 7 rubles 95 kopecks. This, of course, was not a real experiment. It was only by way of sport and diversion. I simply wanted to filch a moment from the future, and to test how I should go and behave. I had decided, even at the very first, even in Moscow, to put off really beginning till I was perfectly free. I fully realized that I must, for instance, finish my work at school. The university, as the listener knows already, I sacrificed. There is no disputing that I went to Petersburg with concealed anger in my heart. No sooner had I left the grammar school and become free for the first time than I suddenly saw that Versilov's affairs would distract me from beginning my enterprise for an indefinite period. But though I was angry, I went to Petersburg feeling perfectly serene about my object. It is true I knew nothing of practical life, but I had been thinking about it for 3 years and could have no doubt about it. I had pictured 1,000 times over how I should begin. I should suddenly find myself as though dropped from the clouds in one of our 2 capitals. I pitched on Petersburg or Moscow for my beginning, and by choice Petersburg, to which I gave the preference through certain considerations. Perfectly free, not dependent on anyone, in good health, and with 100 rubles hidden in my pocket as the capital for my first investment. Without 100 rubles it would be impossible to begin, as without it, even the earliest period of success would be too remote. Apart from my 100 rubles, I should have, as the listener knows already, courage, obstinacy, perseverance, absolute isolation, and secrecy. Isolation was the principal thing. I greatly disliked the idea of any connection or association with others until the last moment. Speaking generally, I proposed beginning my enterprise alone. That was a sine qua non. People weigh upon me, and with them I should have been uneasy, and uneasiness would have hindered my success. Generally speaking, all my life up to now, in all my dreams of how I would behave with people, I always imagined myself being very clever. It was very different in reality. I was always very stupid, and I confess sincerely, with indignation, I always gave myself away and was flustered, and so I resolved to cut people off altogether. I should gain by it independence, tranquillity of mind, and clearness of motive. In spite of the terrible prices in Petersburg, I determined once and for all that I should never spend more than 15 kopecks on food, and I knew I should keep my word. This question of food I had thought over minutely for a long time past. I resolved, for instance, sometimes to eat nothing but bread and salt for 2 days together, and to spend on the third day what I had saved on those 2 days. I fancied that this would be better for my health than a perpetual uniform fast on a minimum of 15 kopecks. Then I needed a corner. Literally, a corner, solely to sleep the night in and to have a refuge in very bad weather. I proposed living in the street, and if necessary, I was ready to sleep in one of the night refuges where they give you a piece of bread and a glass of tea as well as a night's lodging. Oh, I should be quite capable of hiding my money so that it should not be stolen in the corner or in the refuge, and should not even be suspected. I'll answer for that. Steal from me? Why, I'm afraid of stealing myself, I once heard a passer-by in the street say gaily. Of course, I only apply to myself the caution and smartness of it. I don't intend to steal. What is more, while I was in Moscow, perhaps from the very first day of my idea, I resolved that I would not be a pawnbroker or usurer either. There are Jews for that job, and such Russians as have neither intelligence nor character. Pawnbroking and usury are for the commonplace. As for clothes, I resolved to have 2 suits, one for every day and one for best. When once I had got them, I felt sure I should wear them a long time. I purposely trained myself to wear a suit for 2.5 years, and in fact I discovered a secret. For clothes always to look new and not to get shabby, they should be brushed as often as possible, 5 or 6 times a day. Brushing does not hurt the cloth. I speak from knowledge. What does hurt it is dust and dirt. Dust is the same thing as stones if you look at it through the microscope, and however hard a brush is, it is almost the same as fur. I trained myself to wear my boots evenly. The secret lies in putting down the whole sole at once and avoid treading on the side. One can train oneself to this in a fortnight. After that, the habit is unconscious. In this way, boots last on an average 1/3 as long again. That is the experience of 2 years. Then I followed my activity itself. I started with the hypothesis that I had 100 rubles. In Petersburg, there are so many auction sales, petty hucksters' booths, and people who want things, that it would be impossible not to sell anything one bought for a little more. Over the album, I had made 7 rubles 95 kopecks profit on 2 rubles 5 kopecks of capital invested. This immense profit was made without any risk. I could see from his eyes that the purchaser would not back out. Of course, I know quite well that this was only a chance, but it is just such chances I am on the lookout for. That is why I have made up my mind to live in the street. Well, granted that such a chance is unusual, no matter. My first principle will be to risk nothing, and the second, to make every day more than the minimum spent on my subsistence, that the process of accumulation may not be interrupted for a single day. I shall be told that all this is a dream. You don't know the streets, and you'll be taken in at the first step. But I have will and character, and the science of the streets is a science like any other. Persistence, attention, and capacity can conquer it. In the grammar school, right up to the 7th form, I was one of the first. I was very good at mathematics. Why? Can one possibly exaggerate the value of experience and knowledge on the streets to such a fantastic pitch as to predict my failure for certain? That is only what people say who have never made an experiment in anything, have never begun any sort of life, but have grown stiff in second-hand stagnation. One man breaks his nose, so another must break his. No, I won't break mine. I have character, and if I pay attention, I can learn anything. But is it possible to imagine that with constant persistence, with incessant vigilance and continual calculation and reflection, with perpetual activity and alertness, one could fail to find out how to make 20 kopecks to spare every day? Above all, I resolved not to struggle for the maximum profit, but always to keep calm. As time went on, after heaping up 1,000 or 2,000, I should, of course, naturally rise above second-hand dealing and street trading. I know, of course, far too little as yet about the stock exchange, about shares, banking, and all that sort of thing. But to make up for that, I know, as I know I have 5 fingers on my hand, that I should learn all the stock exchange and banking business as well as anyone else, and that the subject would turn out to be perfectly simple, because one is brought to it by practice. What need is there of the wisdom of Solomon, so long as one has character? Efficiency, skill, and knowledge come of themselves, if only one does not leave off willing. The great thing is to avoid risks, and that can only be done if one has character. Not long ago in Petersburg, I had before me a subscription list of shares in some railway investments. Those who succeeded in getting shares made a lot of money. For some time, the shares went up and up. Well, if one day someone who had not succeeded in getting a share or was greedy for more had offered to buy mine at a premium of so much percent, I should certainly have sold it. People would have laughed at me, of course, and have said that if I had waited, I should have made 10 times as much. Quite so. But my premium is safer, for it's a bird in the hand while yours is on the bush. I shall be told that one can't make much like that. Excuse me, that's your mistake. The mistake of all our Kokorovs, Polyakovs, and Gubonins. Let me tell you the truth. Perseverance and persistence in money-making, and still more in saving, is much more effective than these cent-per-cent profits. Not long before the French Revolution, there was a man called Law in Paris, who invented of himself a scheme that was theoretically magnificent, but which came utterly to grief in practice afterwards. All Paris was in excitement. Law's shares were bought up at once before allotment. Money from all parts of Paris poured as from a sack into the house where the shares were subscribed. But the house was not enough at last. The public thronged the street. People of all callings, all classes, all ages, bourgeois, noblemen, their children, countesses, marquises, prostitutes, were all struggling in one infuriated, half-crazy, rabid mob. Rank, the prejudices of birth and pride, even honour and good name, were all trampled in the same mire. All, even women, were ready to sacrifice anyone to gain a few shares. The list at last was passed down into the streets, but there was nothing to write on. Then it was suggested to a hunchback that he should lend his back for the time as a table on which people could sign their names for shares. The hunchback agreed. One can fancy at what a price. Some time, a very short time after, they were all bankrupt. The whole thing went smash. The whole idea was exploded, and the shares were worth nothing. Who got the best of it? Why, the hunchback, because he did not take shares, but louis d'or in cash. Well, I am that hunchback. I had strength of will enough not to eat, and to save 72 rubles out of my kopecks. I shall have strength enough to restrain myself and prefer a safe profit to a large one, even when everyone around me is carried away by a fever of excitement. I am trivial only about trifles, not in what is important. I have often lacked fortitude for enduring little things ever since the inception of my idea, but for enduring big things I shall always have enough. When in the morning my mother gave me cold coffee before I set out to work, I was angry and rude to her, and yet I was the same person who had lived a whole month on bread and water. In short, not to make money, not to learn how to make money, would be unnatural. It would be unnatural, too, in spite of incessant and regular saving, unflagging care and mental sobriety, self-control, economy, and growing energy. It would be unnatural, I repeat, to fail to become a millionaire. How did the beggar make his money, if not by fanatical determination and perseverance? Am I inferior to a beggar? And after all, supposing I don't arrive at anything, suppose my calculation is incorrect, suppose I fall and come to grief. No matter. I shall go on. I shall go on, because I want to. That is what I said in Moscow. I shall be told that there is no idea in this, absolutely nothing new, but I say, and for the last time, that there are an immense number of ideas in it, and a vast amount that is new. Oh, I foresaw how trivial all objections would be, and that I should be as trivial myself in expounding my idea. Why? What have I said, after all? I haven't told 1/100th part of it. I feel that it is trivial, superficial, crude, and somehow too young for my age. I've still to answer the questions, what for and why, whether it's moral and all the rest of it. I've undertaken to answer them. I am sad at disappointing the listener straight off, sad and glad too. Let him know that in my idea there is absolutely no feeling of revenge, nothing Byronic, no curses, no lamentations over my orphaned state, no tears over my illegitimacy, nothing. Nothing of the sort. In fact, if a romantic lady should chance to come across my autobiography, she would certainly turn up her nose. The whole object of my idea is isolation. But one can arrive at isolation without straining to become a Rothschild. What has Rothschild got to do with it? Why, this, that besides isolation, I want power. Let me tell the listener. He will perhaps be horrified at the candour of my confession, and in the simplicity of his heart will wonder how the author could help blushing. But my answer is that I'm not writing for publication, and I may not have a reader for 10 years, and by that time everything will be so thoroughly passed, settled, and defined that there will be no need to blush. And so, if I sometimes in my autobiography appeal to my listener, it is simply a form of expression. My listener is an imaginary figure. No, it was not being illegitimate with which I was so taunted at Touchard's, nor my sorrowful childhood. It was not revenge, nor the desire to protest that was at the bottom of my idea. My character alone was responsible for everything. At 12 years old, I believe that is almost at the dawn of real consciousness, I began to dislike my fellow creatures. It was not that I disliked them exactly, but that their presence weighed upon me. I was sometimes, in my moments of purest sincerity, quite sad that I never could express everything, even to my nearest and dearest. That is, I could, but will not. For some reason I restrain myself, so that I'm mistrustful, sullen and reserved. Again, I have noticed one characteristic in myself almost from childhood, that I am too ready to find fault, and given to blaming others. but this impulse was often followed at once by another which was very irksome to me. I would ask myself whether it were not my fault rather than theirs, and how often I blamed myself for nothing. To avoid such doubts, I naturally sought solitude. Besides, I found nothing in the company of others, however much I tried, and I did try. All the boys of my own age, anyway, all my schoolfellows, all, every one of them, turned out to be inferior to me in their ideas. I don't recall one single exception. Yes, I am a gloomy person. I'm always shutting myself up. I often love to walk out of a room of people. I may perhaps do people a kindness, but often I cannot see the slightest reason for doing them a kindness. People are not such splendid creatures that they are worth taking much trouble about. Why can't they approach me openly and directly? Why must I always be forced to make the first overtures? That is the question I asked myself. I am a grateful creature, and have shown it by 100 imbecilities. If someone were frank with me, I should instantly respond with frankness and begin to love them at once, and so I have done. But they have all deceived me promptly, and have withdrawn from me with a sneer. The most candid of them all was Lambert, who beat me so much as a child. But he was only an open brute and scoundrel, and even his openness was only stupidity. Such was my state of mind when I came to Petersburg. When I came out of Derkachev's, and goodness only knows what made me go to him, I had gone up to Vasin, and in a rush of enthusiasm I had begun singing his praises. And that very evening I felt that I liked him much less. Why? Just because by my praise of him I had demeaned myself before him. Yet one might have thought it would have been the other way. A man just and generous enough to give another his due, even to his own detriment, ought to stand higher in personal dignity than anyone. And though I quite understood this, I did like Vasin less, much less, in fact. I purposely choose an example with which the listener is familiar. I even thought of Kraft with a bitter, sickly feeling, because he had led me into the passage, and this feeling lasted till the day when Kraft's state of mind at the time was revealed, and it was impossible to be angry with him. From the time when I was in the lowest class in the grammar school, as soon as any of my comrades excelled me in schoolwork or witty answers or physical strength, I immediately gave up talking or having anything to do with them. Not that I disliked them or wished them not to succeed, I simply turned away from them, because such was my character. Yes, I thirsted for power. I've thirsted for it all my life. Power and solitude. I dreamed of it at an age when everyone would have laughed at me to my face if they could have guessed what was in my head. That was why I so liked secrecy. And indeed, all my energy went into dreams, so much so that I had no time to talk. This led to my being unsociable, and my absent-mindedness led people to more unpleasant conclusions about me. But my rosy cheeks belied their suspicions. I was particularly happy when, covering myself up in bed at night, I began in complete solitude, with no stir or sound of other people round me, to recreate life on a different plan. I was most desperately dreamy up to the time of the idea, when all my dreams became rational instead of foolish, and passed from the fantastic realms of romance to the reasonable world of reality. Everything was concentrated into one object. Not that they were so very stupid before, although there were masses and masses of them. But I had favourites. There is no need to bring them in here, however. Power. I am convinced that very many people would think it very funny if they knew that such a pitiful creature was struggling for power. But I shall surprise them even more. Perhaps from my very first dreams, that is, almost from my earliest childhood, I could never imagine myself except in the foremost place, always and in every situation in life. I will add a strange confession. It is the same, perhaps, to this day. At the same time, let me observe that I am not apologizing for it. That is the point of my idea. That is the force of it, that money is the one means by which the humblest non-entity may rise to the foremost place. I may not be a non-entity, but I know from the looking-glass that my exterior does not do me justice, for my face is commonplace. But if I were as rich as Rothschild, who would find fault with my face? And wouldn't thousands of women be ready to fly to me with all their charms if I whistled to them? I am sure that they would honestly consider me good-looking. Suppose I am clever. But were I as wise as Solomon, someone would be found wiser still, and I should be done for. But if I were a Rothschild, what would that wise man be beside me? Why, they would not let him say a word beside me. I may be witty, but with Talleyrand or Piron, I'm thrown into the shade. But if I were Rothschild, where would Piron be? And where Talleyrand, even, perhaps? Money is, of course, despotic power, and at the same time it is the greatest leveller, and that is its chief power. Money levels all inequality. I settled all that in Moscow. You will see, of course, in this idea nothing but insolence, violence, the triumph of the non-entity over the talented. I admit that it is an impudent idea, and for that reason a sweet one. But let it pass. You imagine that I desire power to be able to crush, to avenge myself. That is just the point, that is how the commonplace would behave. What is more, I'm convinced that thousands of the wise and talented who were so exalted, if the Rothschilds' millions suddenly fell to their lot, could not resist behaving like the most vulgar and commonplace, and would be more oppressive than any. My idea is quite different. I'm not afraid of money. It won't crush me, and it won't make me crush others. What I want isn't money, or rather, money is not necessary to me, nor power either. I only want what is obtained by power, and cannot be obtained without it. That is, the calm and solitary consciousness of strength. That is, the fullest definition of liberty for which the whole world is struggling. Liberty. At last I have written that grand word. Yes, the solitary consciousness of strength is splendid and alluring. I have strength, and I am serene. With the thunderbolts in his hands, Jove is serene. Are his thunders often heard? The fool fancies that he is asleep, but put a literary man or a peasant woman in Jove's place, and the thunder would never cease. If I only have power, I argued, I should have no need to use it. I assure you that of my own free will I should take the lowest seat everywhere. If I were a Rothschild, I would go about in an old overcoat with an umbrella. What should I care if I were jostled in the crowd, if I had to skip through the mud to avoid being run over? The consciousness that I was myself a Rothschild would even amuse me at the moment. I should know I could have a dinner better than anyone, that I could have the best cook in the world. It would be enough for me to know it. I would eat a piece of bread and ham and be satisfied with the consciousness of it. I think so even now. I shouldn't run after the aristocracy, but they would run after me. I shouldn't pursue women, but they would fly to me like the wind, offering me all that women can offer. The vulgar run after money, but the intelligent are attracted by curiosity to the strange, proud, and reserved being, indifferent to everything. I would be kind, and would give them money, perhaps, but I would take nothing from them. Curiosity arouses passion. Perhaps I may inspire passion. They will take nothing away with them, I assure you, except perhaps presents that will make me twice as interesting to them. To me, enough, the consciousness of this. It is strange but true that I have been fascinated by this picture since I was 17. I don't want to oppress or torment anyone, and I won't, but I know that if I did want to ruin some man, some enemy of mine, no one could prevent me, and everyone would serve me, and that would be enough again. I would not revenge myself on anyone. I could never understand how James Rothschild could consent to become a baron. Why? For what reason? When he was already more exalted than anyone in the world. Oh, let that insolent general insult me at the station while we are both waiting for our horses. If he knew who I was, he would run himself to harness the horses and would hasten to assist me into my modest vehicle. They say that some foreign count or baron at a Vienna railway station put an Austrian banker's slippers on for him in public, and the latter was so vulgar as to allow him to do it. Oh, may that terrible beauty! Yes, terrible, there are such. That daughter of that luxurious and aristocratic lady meeting me by chance on a steamer or somewhere, glance askance at me, and turn up her nose, wondering contemptuously how that humble, unpresentable man with a book or paper in his hand could dare to be in a front seat beside her. If only she knew who was sitting beside her. And she will find out. She will. And will come to sit beside me of her own accord, humble, timid, ingratiating, seeking my glance, radiant at my smile. I purposely introduce these early daydreams to express what was in my mind, but the picture is pale and perhaps trivial. Only reality will justify everything. I shall be told that such a life would be stupid. Why not have a mansion? Keep open house? Gather society round you? Why not have influence? Why not marry? But what would Rothschild be then? He would become like everyone else. All the charm of the idea would disappear, all its moral force. When I was quite a child, I learnt Pushkin's monologue of the miserly knight. Pushkin has written nothing finer in conception than that. I have the same ideas now. But yours is too low an ideal, I shall be told with contempt. Money, wealth, very different from the common weal, from self-sacrifice for humanity. But how can anyone tell how I should use my wealth? In what way is it immoral? In what way is it degrading that these millions should pass out of dirty, evil Jewish hands into the hands of a sober and resolute ascetic with a keen outlook upon life? All these dreams of the future, all these conjectures seem like a romance now. And perhaps I am wasting time in recording them. I might have kept them to myself. I know, too, that these lines will very likely be read by no one. But if anyone were to read them, would he believe that I should be unable to stand the test of the Rothschild millions? Not because they would crush me, quite the contrary. More than once in my dreams I have anticipated that moment in the future when my consciousness will be satiated and power will not seem enough for me. Then, not from ennui, not from aimless weariness, but because I have a boundless desire for what is great, I shall give all my millions away. Let society distribute all my wealth, and I will mix with nothingness again. Maybe I will turn into a beggar, like the one who died on the steamer, with the only difference that they wouldn't find money sewn up in my shirt. The mere consciousness that I had had millions in my hands and had flung them away into the dirt like trash would sustain me in my solitude. I am ready to think the same even now. Yes, my idea is a fortress in which I can always, at every turn, take refuge from everyone. even if I were a beggar dying on a steamer. It is my poem, and let me tell you that I must have the whole of my vicious will simply to prove to myself that I can renounce it. No doubt I shall be told that this is all romance, and that if I got my millions I should not give them up and become a beggar. Perhaps I should not. I have simply sketched the ideal in my mind. But I will add seriously that if I did succeed in piling up as much money as Rothschild, that it really might end in my giving it all up to the public, though it would be difficult to do so before I reach that amount. And I shouldn't give away half, because that would be simply vulgar. I should be only half as rich, that would be all. I should give away all to the last farthing, for on becoming a beggar, I should become twice as rich as Rothschild. If other people don't understand this, it's not my fault. I'm not going to explain it. The fanaticism, the romanticism of insignificance and impotence, people will pronounce, the triumph of commonplaceness and mediocrity. Yes, I admit that it is, in a way, the triumph of commonplaceness and mediocrity, but surely not of impotence. I used to be awfully fond of imagining just such a creature, commonplace and mediocre, facing the world and saying to it with a smile, "You are Galileos and Copernicuses, Charlemagne's and Napoleon's. You are Pushkins and Shakespeare's. You are field marshals and generals. And I am incompetence and illegitimacy. And yet I am higher than all of you, because you bow down to it yourself." I admit that I have pushed this fancy to such extremes that I have struck out even my education. It seemed to me more picturesque if the man were sordidly ignorant. This exaggerated dream had a positive influence at the time on my success in the seventh form of the grammar school. I gave up working simply from fanaticism, feeling that lack of education would add a charm to my ideal. Now I've changed my views on that point. Education does not detract from it. Gentlemen, can it be that even the smallest independence of mind is so distasteful to you? Blessed he who has an ideal of beauty, even though it be a mistaken one. But I believe in mine. It is only that I've explained it clumsily, crudely. In 10 years, of course, I should explain it better, and I treasure that in my memory. I've finished with my idea. If my account of it has been commonplace and superficial, it is I that am to blame, and not the idea. I have already pointed out that the simplest ideas are always the most difficult to understand. Now I will add that they are also the most difficult to explain. Moreover, I have described my idea in its earliest phase. The converse is the rule with ideas. Commonplace and shallow ideas are extraordinarily quickly understood, and are invariably understood by the crowd, by the whole street. What is more, they are regarded as very great, and as the ideas of genius, but only for the day of their appearance. The cheap never wears. For a thing to be quickly understood is only a sign of its commonplaceness. Bismarck's idea was received as a stroke of genius instantly, and Bismarck himself was looked on as a genius. But the very rapidity of its reception was suspicious. Wait for 10 years, and then we shall see what remains of the idea and of Bismarck himself. I introduce this extremely irrelevant observation, of course, not for the sake of comparison, but also for the sake of remembering it. An explanation for the too unmannerly listener. And now I will tell 2 anecdotes to wind up my account of the idea, that it may not hinder my story again. In July, 2 months before I came to Petersburg, when my time was all my own, Marie Ivanovna asked me to go to see an old maiden lady who was staying in the Troitsky suburb to take her a message of no interest for my story. Returning the same day, I noticed in the railway carriage an unattractive-looking young man, not very poorly, though grubbily dressed, with a pimply face and a muddy, dark complexion. He distinguished himself by getting out at every station, big and little, to have a drink. Towards the end of the journey, he was surrounded by a merry throng of very low companions. One merchant, also a little drunk, was particularly delighted at the young man's power of drinking incessantly without becoming drunk. Another person, who was awfully pleased with him, was a very stupid young fellow who talked a great deal. He was wearing European dress and smelt most unsavoury. He was a footman, as I found out afterwards. This fellow got quite friendly with the young man who was drinking, and every time the train stopped, roused him with the invitation, "It's time for a drop of vodka," and they got out with their arms round each other. The young man who drank scarcely said a word, but yet more and more companions joined him. He only listened to their chatter, grinning incessantly with a drivelling snigger, and only from time to time, always unexpectedly, brought out a sound something like "Tchurlulu," while he put his finger up to his nose in a very comical way. This diverted the merchant and the footman and all of them, and they burst into very loud and free and easy laughter. It is sometimes impossible to understand why people laugh. I joined them too, and I don't know why. The young man attracted me too, perhaps by his very open disregard for the generally accepted conventions and proprieties. I didn't see, in fact, that he was simply a fool. Anyway, I got on to friendly terms with him at once, and as I got out of the train, I learnt from him that he would be in the Tverskoy Boulevard between 8 and 9. It appeared that he had been a student. I went to the boulevard, and this was the diversion he taught me. We walked together up and down the boulevards, and a little later, as soon as we noticed a respectable woman walking along the street, if there were no one else near, we fastened upon her. Without uttering a word, we walked one on each side of her, and, with an air of perfect composure as though we didn't see her, began to carry on a most unseemly conversation. We called things by their names, preserving unruffled countenances, as though it were the natural thing to do. We entered into such subtleties in our description of all sorts of filth and obscenity as the nastiest mind of the lewdest debauchee could hardly have conceived. I had, of course, acquired all this knowledge at the boarding school before I went to the grammar school, though I knew only words, nothing of the reality. The woman was dreadfully frightened, and made haste to try and get away, but we quickened our pace too, and went on in the same way. Our victim, of course, could do nothing. It was no use to cry out, there were no spectators. Besides, it would be a strange thing to complain of. I repeated this diversion for 8 days. I can't think how I can have liked doing it, though indeed I didn't like doing it, I simply did it. At first I thought it original, as something outside everyday conventions and conditions. Besides, I couldn't endure women. I told once the student that in his Confessions, Jean-Jacques Rousseau describes how, as a youth, he used to behave indecently in the presence of women. The student responded with his "Tchurlulu." I noticed that he was extraordinarily ignorant, and that his interests were astonishingly limited. There was no trace in him of any latent idea such as I had hoped to find in him. Instead of originality, I found nothing in him but a wearisome monotony. I disliked him more and more. The end came quite unexpectedly. One night, when it was quite dark, we persecuted a girl who was quickly and timidly walking along the boulevard. She was very young, perhaps 16 or even less, very tidily and modestly dressed. Possibly a working girl, hurrying home from work to an old widowed mother with other children. There is no need to be sentimental, though. The girl listened for some time, and hurried as fast as she could, with her head bowed and her veil drawn over her face, frightened and trembling. But suddenly she stood still, threw back her veil, showing, as far as I remember, a thin but pretty face, and cried with flashing eyes, "Oh, what scoundrels you are!" She may have been on the verge of tears, but something different happened. Lifting her little arm, she gave the student a slap in the face which could not have been more dexterously delivered. It did come with a smack. He would have rushed at her, swearing, but I held him back, and the girl had time to run away. We began quarrelling at once. I told him all I had been saving up against him in those days. I told him he was the paltriest commonplace fool, without the trace of an idea. He swore at me. I had once explained to him that I was illegitimate. Then we spat at each other, and I've never seen him since. I felt frightfully vexed with myself that evening, but not so much the next day, and by the day after I had quite forgotten it. And though I sometimes thought of that girl again, it was only casually, for a moment. It was only after I had been a fortnight in Petersburg I suddenly recalled the whole scene. I remembered it, and I was suddenly so ashamed that tears of shame literally ran down my cheeks. I was wretched the whole evening and all that night, and I am rather miserable about it now. I could not understand at first how I could have sunk to such a depth of degradation, and still less how I could have forgotten it without feeling shame or remorse. It is only now that I understand what was at the root of it. It was all due to my idea. Briefly, I conclude that, having something fixed, permanent, and overpowering in one's mind, in which one is terribly absorbed, one is, as it were, removed by it from the whole world, and everything that happens, except the one great thing, slips by one. Even one's impressions are hardly formed correctly, and what matters most, one always has an excuse. However much I worried my mother at that time, however disgracefully I neglected my sister, "Oh, I've my idea, nothing else matters," was what I said to myself, as it were. If I were slighted and hurt, I withdrew in my mortification and at once said to myself, "Ah, I'm humiliated, but I still have my idea, and they know nothing about that." The idea comforted me in disgrace and insignificance, but all the nasty things I did took refuge, as it were, under the idea. It, so to speak, smoothed over everything, but it also put a mist before my eyes, and such a misty understanding of things and events may, of course, be a great hindrance to the idea itself, to say nothing of other things. Now for another anecdote. On the 1st of April last year, Marie Ivanovna was keeping her name day. Some visitors, though only a few, came for the evening. Suddenly, Agrafena rushed in, out of breath, announcing that a baby was crying in the passage before the kitchen and that she didn't know what to do. We were all excited at the news. We went out and saw a bark basket, and in the basket a 3 or 4 weeks-old child crying. I picked up the basket and took it into the kitchen. Then I immediately found a folded note. "Gracious benefactors, show kind charity to the girl christened Arina, and we will join with her to send our tears to the heavenly throne for you forever, and congratulate you on your name day. Persons unknown to you." Then Nikolai Semyonovitch, for whom I have such a respect, greatly disappointed me. He drew a very long face and decided to send the child at once to the foundling home. I felt very sad. They lived very frugally, but had no children, and Nikolai Semyonovitch was always glad of it. I carefully took little Arina out of the basket and held her up under the arms. The basket had that sour, pungent odour characteristic of a small child which has not been washed for a long time. I opposed Nikolai Semyonovitch, and suddenly announced that I would keep the child at my expense. In spite of his gentleness, he protested with some severity, and, though he ended by joking, he adhered to his intention in regard to the foundling. I got my way, however. In the same block of buildings, but in a different wing, there lived a very poor carpenter, an elderly man given to drink, but his wife, a very healthy and still youngish peasant woman, had only just lost a baby, and, what is more, the only child she had had in 8 years of marriage, also a girl, and, by a strange piece of luck, also called Arina. I call it good luck, because while we were arguing in the kitchen, the woman, hearing of what had happened, ran in to look at the child, and when she learned that it was called Arina, she was greatly touched. She still had milk, and, unfastening her dress, she put the baby to her breast. I began persuading her to take the child home with her, saying I would pay for it every month. She was afraid her husband would not allow it, but she took it for the night. Next morning, her husband consented to her keeping it for 8 rubles a month, and I immediately paid him for the first month in advance. He at once spent the money on drink. Nikolai Semyonovitch, still with a strange smile, agreed to guarantee that the money should be paid regularly every month. I would have given my 60 rubles into Nikolai Semyonovitch's keeping as security, but he would not take it. He knew, however, that I had the money and trusted me. Our momentary quarrel was smoothed over by this delicacy on his part. Marie Ivanovna said nothing, but wondered at my undertaking such a responsibility. I particularly appreciated their delicacy in refraining from the slightest jest at my expense, but on the contrary, taking the matter with proper seriousness. I used to run over to the carpenter's wife 3 times a day, and at the end of a week I slipped an extra 3 rubles into her hand without her husband's knowledge. For another 3, I bought a little quilt and swaddling clothes. But 10 days later, little Arina fell ill. I called in a doctor at once. He wrote a prescription, and we were up all night, tormenting the mite with horrid medicine. Next day he declared that he had been sent for too late, and answered my entreaties, which I fancy were more like reproaches, by saying with majestic evasiveness, "I am not God." The baby's little tongue and lips and whole mouth were covered with a minute white rash, and towards evening she died, gazing at me with her big black eyes as though she understood already. I don't know why I never thought to take a photograph of the dead baby, but will it be believed that I cried that evening, and in fact I howled as I had never let myself do before? And Marie Ivanovna had tried to comfort me. Again, without the least mockery, either on her part or on Nikolai Semyonovitch's. The carpenter made a little coffin, and Marie Ivanovna finished it with a frill and a pretty little pillow, while I bought flowers and strewed them on the baby. So they carried away my poor little Blossom, whom it will hardly be believed I can't forget even now. A little afterwards, however, this sudden adventure made me reflect seriously. Little Arina had not cost me much, of course. The coffin, the burial, the doctor, the flowers, and the payment to the carpenter's wife came altogether to 30 rubles. As I was going to Petersburg, I made up this sum from the 40 rubles sent me by Versilov for the journey, and from the sale of various articles before my departure, so that my capital remained intact. But I thought, if I am going to be turned aside like this, I shan't get far. The affair with the student showed that the idea might absorb me till it blurred my impressions and drew me away from the realities of life. The incident with little Arina proved, on the contrary, that no idea was strong enough to absorb me, at least so completely that I should not stop short in the face of an overwhelming fact and sacrifice to it at once all that I had done for the idea by years of labour. Both conclusions were nevertheless true.